come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Bill Frank. When you think of high-speed, high-impact businesses, you might think of Google, Facebook, Apple, or Amazon. These four businesses, however, are the tip of the iceberg. My next guest believes businesses, including legacy low-tech ones, can create urgency and growth in a nanosecond culture. We'll discuss the implications for business, the economy, and society in general from his book, The High-Speed Company. Jason Jennings is a researcher and one of the most successful and prolific business and leadership authors in the world. His greatest thrill is helping lead individuals and companies to their full economic potential. In total, Jennings and his team have screened and studied more than 120,000 companies to write The High-Speed Company. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing today?
Bill, it's great to be back with you.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thanks for being a guest. Great new book. Loved it. I love your factual research-based writing. But I want to get right into it and sort of challenge you right from the get-go.
All
because
right.
If we look back through history, and I'm not talking ancient history, just recent history, two-thirds of the companies on the Fortune 500 list in 2000 dropped off the list by 2010. That's just 10 years later. During the decade, we saw two bubbles burst, the tech bubble and followed by the real estate bubble. So my question to you is this: how much of the changes in the Fortune 500 leadership happened because the legacy companies were stagnant or didn't see the changes coming?
I would say virtually all of it, Bill. Consider Budweiser. It's not that many years ago that Budweiser sold 1 out of 4 beers in America. Today, it's 1 out of 12. And you have to ask the question, why? They had an incredible brand. They had vast financial resources, they had tremendous intellect, and a lot of smart people, and they missed it. Take a look at just a couple of years ago, BlackBerry had a market capitalization of $86 billion, and everybody was a radical fan. Today, their market capitalization is a few billion dollars equal to the amount of cash they have in the bank. Their enterprise value is zero. And so you have to ask the question, why does this happen? In fact, 97.5% of the companies off the original Fortune 500 list are gone. I can only suggest to you that they became entitled. They got very, very lazy. They took their success for granted, and they disappeared. And that's why every organization that wants to remain relevant, I mean, must become an organization of urgency and growth, and it's nonstop.
Well, let's talk about relevancy, because in your book, you do mention the stagnation, you do mention this whole sense of entitlement, but you also talk about having a sense of purpose. In fact, it's one of the real driving themes in the book. So I want to wrestle with one of business's greatest paradoxes.
Okay.
Does a company do well because it does good, or does it do good because it does well? I mean, historically, business leaders have chosen the second path. You do well, and then you use a portion of your profits to do philanthropic good deeds and so forth. You take the opposite opinion. Why?
Yeah, I'm actually going to go out on a limb here, and there's an old German phrase that I'm not sure if it translates well into English, but self-praise stinks. But I will go out on the same limb and tell you that I think the first chapter in this new book is probably one of the most important chapters that has ever been written about business. After our exhaustive research, we were led to one place. Companies, high-speed companies, whether they're small companies, medium-sized companies, or large companies, that master creating urgency and growth, share one huge thing in common, and that is they have a purpose built around doing something good. They allow to happen is they allow to the business brain to somehow touch the heart as well. And we found it consistently in every high-speed company we identified. Let me give you a couple of quick examples.
Sure.
CoBank is one of the nation's largest banks based in Denver, Colorado. They specialize in lending to farmers, ranches, and rural cooperatives. Big bank, $100 billion bank. They make a net profit every year of $1 million per employee.
Wow.
Now, let's compare that to the typical bank. The typical bank earns $20,000, $30,000, $35,000 in profit per employee per year. So how do they do 20 to 50 times what the average bank does? as Bob Engel says, mere mortals can't do what we have consistently done for years and years and years. He said, what we do is we serve rural America. And there is not one person who can work here or have a place at the table here, I mean, who is not called to serve rural America. All of your listeners will be familiar with W.W. Granger and their 500 or 600 locations across the country. To look at them from the outside, you say, well, that's a pretty boring company. They sell pots and pans and pails and soaps and towels and mops and steel-toed work boots. But they're an $11 billion company. They own the marketplace. They've just left their nearest competitors eating their dust. And when I asked Jim Ryan, I said, how can you take such a kind of a boring business and make it so incredibly successful just by selling these mundane goods? And he said, is that what you think we do? And I said, well, that's what you sell. He said, yeah, that's what we sell, but that's not what we do. He said, we exist to help people get their work done safely. And he said, there's not one person who works for us that can't recite that and doesn't believe that. We exist to help people get their work done safely. We found that the one common thing that tied all of these high-speed enterprises together is they exist because they have a purpose for doing something good that is shared by everybody in the organization.
My guest is Jason Jennings. He's author of the new book, The High-Speed Company, Creating Urgency and Growth in a Nanosecond Culture. And I want to drill down just one second further on this point of purpose, on this point of having an overriding mission, if I can, for just a minute, and use something very timely, Starbucks, which is a fast-growing company now that Howard Schultz is back at the helm of the company. But they took a giant misstep trying to do good with their most recent campaign. So talk to us about that. I mean, companies I know can make missteps, and I get that. But why? What made the Starbucks misstep backfire so dramatically for them?
You know, I actually have written about Starbucks in a number of books, and I've known Howard Schultz since we were students together at Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan. So I go way back. And it is a company, but they're with a strong purpose. And their purpose is to make the lives of all of their associates and workers better. And that's what they've done. And when Howard Schultz came back as the CEO, they had stumbled to $9 billion in revenue. Under his direction, they're back at about $19 billion in revenue, have grown to 19,000 locations. And they do incredible things to help their workers achieve prosperity. For example, guaranteeing a college education paid for to everybody who works there more than 20 hours a week. He is also a delightful, impetuous man who does not like injustice, and I think sometimes he just goes a little bit off the wall, and I think that's one of the things that makes him adorable.
All right. Adorable, Howard Schultz.
I will
quote you on that.
That's absolutely great. Adorable.
All right. Well, Jason, let me change it up on you, because obviously you're making a strong case here for having principles, having a guiding value and so forth, a core purpose. You use a great example in the book that I absolutely loved about illustrating values and principles and purposes. So if you would please share with my listeners the example that you use of capturing a fortress on a hill and explain exactly how it defines strategic objectives, tactics, and values.
Okay. Well, over the past decade, or 15 years, Bill, it has become very, very popular for every company, small, medium, and large, again, to go away, have a weekend retreat, and create this list of core values, or what I call guiding principles. There is only one problem with that. They are not guiding principles in 99.9% of all companies, because not everybody knows what they are. They don't believe them. They've never been told them. They've never studied them. And they're not used to guide and make every decision within the company. So every civilization, every culture, every organization that has withstood the test of time and prospered has had a set of rules of the road. So the story I use in the book and I use in many of my lectures is I ask people to imagine themselves, and I normally don't use sports examples and military examples. I shy away from them. But I ask them to imagine themselves as the commander of a military that is at war with an evil force. And they've been at war for a long time. And the war is almost won. There's only one last enemy stronghold up in a high mountainous region. And as soon as they take the enemy out from there, they're going to declare victory. The war is going to be won. Goodness is going to prevail. And then I look out at the audience and I ask the question, so how would you take them out? I mean, how would you take out this last enemy stronghold? And people say, bomb them, starve them, cut off the water, internal subversion, a nuclear bomb. I mean, everybody's got all. And I ask them, I mean, just let loose and come up with all the ideas how you take them out. And then I say, oh, I forgot to give you a little piece of information. And that little piece of information is they're holding 300 young children hostage. Would you want to take some of those options off the table? Oh, my God, yes. I mean, you wouldn't bomb them, and you wouldn't starve them. I mean, you'd take some of the options off the table. And I always say, well, why would you take some of the options off the table? I say, well, I don't know. It's just it's wrong. It goes against my principles. And you see, every organization has to have four or five guiding principles by which they make every decision. The reason that most companies suffer from paralysis by analysis, the reason they don't get the 70% of the workforce, according to the Gallup poll last year, engaged in their business, is because they don't have a set of guiding principles, which are the rules of the road for everybody. And so decisions can be made in a split second. You don't need 8 people or 10 people sitting around a conference table, I mean, puffing their chests and sharing their point of view and having to be heard, building PowerPoint presentations. Meetings actually can be 3 or 4 people meeting in a hallway, considering something and saying, well, it fits the guiding principles or it doesn't fit the guiding principles, so let's do it or let's don't do it. But you cannot, as an organization, say you have a list of guiding principles unless everybody knows them, buys into them, believes them, and makes every decision in accordance with them. So, Bill, I would say, and I know our time is limited, yeah, but if you just did those two things we talked about so far, if you had a sense of purpose known by everybody in the organization, and everybody was behind that sense of purpose, and if you had a set of guiding principles by which all decisions were made, think about how much faster you would be at solving problems the first time. That's what makes a company fast. Keeping good customers from defecting. That's what makes a company fast. Getting those 70% of the workers who are not engaged on board. That's what makes a company fast. Fast companies have nothing to do with moving frantically, running around wildly, or being out of breath or operating with haste.
My guest is Jason Jennings, author of the new book, The High Speed Company. Jason, I want to drill down on something else, too. You use a catchphrase in the book, and you call it the immutable law of suckage. Yet, if you ask most company leaders, and this has been my experience, they'll tell you, oh, gosh, our customers love us. So what is the immutable law of suckage? Great term, by the way.
Thank you very much. It's the one term that we accidentally stumbled on during the writing of the book, and I look forward to my speeches to being able to use it because it brings the house down. So when I look at the audience and I say, well, it just flies in the face of the immutable law of suckage, everybody kind of sits there and wonders and waits for the penny to drop, and I say, oh, you don't know the law of suckage? By the time the immutable law of suckage says, by the time you figure out you suck, you have sucked for a very long, long time. And it literally brings the house down. And I would say, and I know this is a strong statement, I believe that probably 90% of business owners and CEOs are delusional. Very recently, a couple of years ago, we talked about it in the book, Bain and Company did this incredible survey of several hundred CEOs. And they asked them, if they thought that they offered exceptional service to their customers. And something like 92% of them said, yes, we do. And then Bain and Company went to the customers and said, do they offer exceptional service? And like more than 80% of them said, no, they sure don't. I mean, you know, if you believe you're offering exceptional customer service, but more than 80% of your customers say you're not, you're absolutely delusional.
That makes perfect sense. It does. Now, Jason, I want you to think back and reflect on this book, because you've written many books. But what do you see? What one thing do you see differently after writing The High Speed Company? And did it come as a surprise to you?
Wow. You're just always so good, because you study the books and you cut to the chase and you ask the really good questions. Yes, I did walk away from the research for this book and the writing of this book with something which gives me a very positive attitude in life and hope going forward, and that is this. When I was sitting with Bob Engel $1,000 in profit per employee per year, and returns half of that to their shareholders. I said, how is it possible that you do this consistently? I mean, it's impossible. Nobody else has ever done this. And he said, you're right. He said, mere mortals couldn't do what we do. He said, but Jason, let me tell you why we're able to do it. He said, if you give people the why, they will give you the how.
That is a remarkable quote, and obviously one worth remembering. My guest is Jason Jennings. He's the author of the new book, The High-Speed Company, Creating Urgency and Growth in a Nanosecond Culture. Jason, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book?
I want them to understand that speed has nothing to do with moving physically fast or hastily or being out of control. It has to do with a very short list. Solving problems the first time, keeping good customers from defecting, engaging the 70% of the workforce that are not engaged right now engaged, allowing people to admit mistakes, not covering them up, and becoming a learning organization, encouraging people to improvise, filling jobs with people who like getting things done quickly, and reducing resistance to new ideas. If you did all of those things simultaneously, you have just guaranteed your relevance going forward.
That is remarkable. My guest has been Jason Jennings, author of the book, The High Speed Company. Jason, if you've piqued the interest of some of my listeners and they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
Well, I direct them to Hudson's Bookstores, every place in the United States, obviously Amazon and the other websites, and they can always visit my website at jason-jennings.com, and there's lots of neat stuff on the website.
And it's important to put the dash in there because there is another Jason Jennings running out there. It is Jason
Jennings. That damn baseball player.
Yes.
That damn baseball player, Bill.
There you go. Jason, it has been a delight as always. Thank you so much for being my guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Bill, I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.